This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. 2 decades after the end of the Cold War, it's a fair question to ask, are we any safer from the threat of nuclear annihilation? We start to get scared again when we hear news of a newly bold Russia asserting itself against its neighbors. We got so scared by faulty intelligence that we went to war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq in order to preempt his development of weapons of mass destruction. We even got a little nervous about the story of U.S. cruise missiles going missing. Only later did we find out that they were on an Air Force plane flying over our own airspace. But despite these fears, are we really considering the role of nuclear weapons in our lives? Today, Where We Live, a conversation previewing a major conference at Yale Divinity School called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. We'll talk about the realities of nuclear disarmament, nuclear terrorism, and nuclear war, and we'd like you to join the conversation. Who has the right to possess nuclear weapons? Can we really disarm the whole world? You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266, or you can email wherewelive@wnpr.org. First, I'd like to bring in Reverend Tyler Wiggs Stevenson, Policy Director of Faithful Security. It's a national religious partnership on the nuclear weapons danger. Also, he's the director of the Two Futures Project. The Divinity School at Yale is putting together this conference. Tyler Wiggs Stevenson, maybe you can give a sense of what you're hoping to get out of these 2 days.
Well, in the 1980s, as many listeners I think will probably know, the religious community played a vital role in helping define the issues and really bring a full consideration of what it meant to have these weapons and what it meant to threaten their use. With the end of the Cold War, the perception of danger at least went away, and so did a lot of the energy that was devoted to the topic. Well, I think this conference at Yale can really be viewed as one major foot in the door for the religious community bringing its resources to bear again on the question of nuclear weapons in the second nuclear age, which is defined by a whole different set of parameters than were there in the Cold War.
So it's going to be a broad-ranging discussion over the course of 2 days, bringing in a lot of moral questions as well as a lot of very technical questions about nuclear weapons. Give me a sense of what ground you hope to cover.
Well, I think what we're really trying to do is stake out the parameters for asking the right questions. I mean, the technical advice is out there. People, you have policymakers and you have technical experts who are weighing in saying it's really time to disarm. It's the only way that we're going to achieve security for ourselves and for the world is to get rid of nuclear weapons altogether. What hasn't been there so much is an overarching consideration of, you know, what are we really looking at about in terms of the morality of our foreign policy? What are we looking at in terms of what it means for 5 nuclear weapon states and then 4 unofficial ones to say to the world, we need nuclear weapons, but you shouldn't have them? There are big questions, and because nuclear weapons raise such existential threats, because they call into question the very matter of life on the planet, I think it's fitting that people of faith from all traditions would bring the resources of their tradition to bear in terms of addressing that issue and saying, you know, when we mine the riches of our tradition, this is how we come at the topic.
Tyler Wiggs Stevenson joins us in studio. He's Policy Director of Faithful Security and Director of the Two Futures Project. He's part of a Yale Divinity School forum that's taking place September 18th and 19th on the issues of vulnerability, security, and nuclear weapons from the perspective of faith. This is Where We Live, and we're talking about nuclear weapons today on the program. Joining us by phone, Jonathan Schell, a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and the Peace and Disarmament correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's going to be teaching a course at Yale University. He has a recent book called The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of the Nuclear Danger. Jonathan Schell joins us on the phone from Brooklyn. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you.
Could you please give me a sense right now for our audience of what the nuclear threat, as we'll call it, really looks like right now? How many nuclear weapons are in the world? Who has them?
Well, the number in the world is in the range of about 20,000. They've been dropping among the great powers. There are 9 countries that have got them. That is the United States, Russia, China, France, England, India, Pakistan, and Israel, and North Korea. And I think what's happened, as Tyler was saying, is that the whole dilemma took a certain shape during the Cold War, and people thought that pretty much was what the shape of the nuclear dilemma was, 2 giant powers glowering at one another across the globe, threatening each other with mutual assured destruction. And what's happened since then is that that threat has been at least politically reduced, although let's remember, and it's a key thing to remember, that the arsenals are still out there in thousands on each side. And but it's sort of spread out at the base. And we have a couple of other powers kind of waiting in the wings that might get into this business, such as Iran. 10 or 11 countries in the Middle East have expressed a new interest in nuclear power, which is widely believed to be a stepping stone and is a stepping stone often to nuclear weapons. And all of that really was kind of inherent in the problem from the very beginning, because nuclear weapons really are based on certain scientific facts and technology, and it's just in the nature of technology, you know, consider TV or just like a refrigerator or anything else, to become easier to produce, better known to everybody. And so we're really, in a certain sense, strange to say, at this moment, we're facing the nuclear dilemma in its kind of destined form, which was to be global, to be rising at all points of the compass. And so what's really needed now, in a way that was not true in the Cold War, is a global approach to the whole thing.
Of course, the Cold War countries, the United States and Russia, those still control most of the world's nuclear weapons. What percentage of all the weapons are really controlled by these still two major powers?
Well, it's about 95%, give or take a percent or two, because the United States and Russia still have the mother load of the weapons. It's hard to put an exact figure on it because that's classified, but it's, as I say, right there, it's in the order of 20,000. And if you add up the arsenals of all the other nuclear powers in the world put together, they don't come to 1,500. So we're... And this, again, I think it's a distortion in our way of seeing things right now that needs to be corrected, and I think one of the things that this conference can help to do. And that is that when we think of nuclear weapons today, we tend to think of a country like Iran seeking to get them, or a North Korea that just got its hands on them. But once again, and this has been true since the very beginning of the nuclear age, the great preponderance of these weapons has been in the hands, really, of the two countries, first the United States, then the Soviet Union, now Russia, of course. And these arsenals, sort of quietly, even though unnoticed here at home and really sort of completely forgotten about, radiate their influence out around the world. Because if we aren't looking at them, believe me, in China, let's say, they are, and they're worried about it, and they're thinking about it, and they're taking steps to counter what they fear might be superiority or nuclear first strike against them, and that radiates throughout Asia, India, Pakistan, and so on. And so part of what needs to happen is we need to wake up and realize that we still are sitting on huge piles of nuclear weapons right here in this country, and the same is, of course, true in Russia.
Jonathan Schell, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, joins us by phone as we have a conversation today about nuclear disarmament in advance of a Yale Divinity School conference, a two-day conference on this subject coming up. Now I'd like to bring into the conversation Jonathan Granoff. He's president of the Global Security Institute and co-chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Nuclear Nonproliferation and senior advisor to the National Security Committee of the International Law Section of the American Bar Association. A long title, Jonathan Granoff, but I do welcome you here. I want to ask you about the current treaties that are in place. What sort of, I suppose, legal protections does the world provide itself against nuclear arms? What treaties are in place currently, and what are nations looking at right at this moment?
Thank you very much. The core treaty addressing nuclear weapons is the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. During the 1960s, the KGB and the CIA both concluded that absent a treaty preventing proliferation of these weapons, there would be dozens of nuclear weapon states. So when Richard Nixon brought the treaty into effect in 1970, it contained within it a core bargain that said if a country restrains itself from developing nuclear weapons, it would gain access to peaceful uses of nuclear technology. It also contained the provision that the nuclear weapon states, in exchange for the nonproliferation commitments, would negotiate the elimination of nuclear weapons. So in 2000, at the review of this treaty, all 189 countries of the world, parties to the treaty, all countries in the world except for India, Pakistan, and Israel, made an unequivocal undertaking to obtain the total elimination of nuclear weapons, but not overnight. They set forth a set of practical steps that would increase our security, reinforce international law, make every nation safer. Those included a treaty banning any further testing of nuclear weapons to prevent new countries from coming into the club and to prevent those that have them from increasing their capacity. A fissile material cutoff treaty stopping the production of any more nuclear materials, the most dangerous aspect of this venture, lowering the status of nuclear weapons and policies. The treaty was then again reviewed in 2005, and the United States' position was our previous commitments cannot be reviewed. This caused a tremendous ripple effect through the international community regarding the United States' commitment to the rule of law. So presently, there's an ambiguity. Is the United States advancing security through the rule of law, or are we trying to advance global security outside of the rule of law through threat? That's the legal status, and it's ironic that we instituted this key treaty. Our country is based on the rule of law, and we've more than anybody else put it into question. The other legal aspect that's very important is the unanimous decision of the International Court of Justice, which called for negotiations leading to the elimination of nuclear weapons. So the legal status is there's a duty on the part of all the nuclear weapon states to negotiate the elimination of these nuclear weapons. There's a roadmap to doing so that takes place over an extended period of time that operates very reasonably, very rationally, very practically, but we don't have the political will in the United States. I think it's largely because people are unaware of the practical steps to make us safer and the legal requirements to do so.
Jonathan Granoff, they're talking about the rule of law. Jonathan Schell, I know that that's something that you write about in your book, The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of the Nuclear Danger, and the Bush administration's role right now in the world and how it has not exactly helped this idea of ridding the world of nuclear weapons.
To put it mildly, yes, they in the aftermath of 9/11, they really embarked on a kind of a quiet revolution in nuclear strategy, which, by the way, I think is being, in all fairness, is being rolled back now to a certain extent. But they established something called Global Strike, and this was, on the one side, a concept, and on the other side, it was an actual command in the Air Force. And the idea there was to enable the president to hit any spot in the world just in a matter of an hour or a few minutes that he desired to strike with either conventional or nuclear weapons. So really two things were done there that were very radical and very revolutionary, if you bothered to notice them or took them seriously, which few did. But on the one side, it meant that the targeting of American nuclear weapons was extended formally from the old Soviet territories, now Russia, et cetera, and maybe China and a couple of other trouble spots, to, at least in conceptually, to the entire world. So it really became a global nuclear targeting strategy. Now, admittedly, they didn't have a sort of a plan to blow up Nairobi and Buenos Aires and so on and so forth, but the idea was to have the entire Earth covered with conventional or nuclear. That was number one. Number two was that they mingled in a way that had not been done during the Cold War, the nuclear armament and the nuclear threat with the conventional threat, mixing those two up, whereas previously the idea had been that there was a very, very strong and, if not unbreachable, then very difficult to breach threshold between the conventional and the nuclear. So those were two very important things. But right now, I think they're in the process of revision, and they're trying to consolidate the nuclear command, according to news that's just been coming out in the last week or so. And maybe they're going to draw back from some of these extreme policies, which never, by the way, were implemented.
The threat of nuclear weapons is what we're talking about on the program today. Over the next 2 days at Yale Divinity School, there's a forum, and it's called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. We're talking with Jonathan Schell, Senior Fellow at the Nation Institute by phone, also Jonathan Granoff, President of the Global Security Institute, and the Reverend Tyler Wigg Stevenson, the Director of the Two Futures Project. We'd like to take your phone calls, questions about nuclear arms in the world, 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear from you as well. Who has the right to possess nuclear weapons? Can we really disarm the whole world? 860-275-7266, or email us wherewelive@wnpr.org.
World changes are being made here in Connecticut.
Because really, we now live in a world which is so interdependent that whatever happens in any region of the world affects all of us, even though in some aspects we may fall short. In other areas, we are probably doing well.
Listen for the Capital Region Reporting Initiative on Morning Edition, Where We Live and All Things Considered. Support for the Capital Region Reporting Initiative comes from the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving. For more, go to WNPR.org, keyword capital.
Funding for WNPR comes from our members and from The Gunnery, a boarding and day college preparatory school in Washington, Connecticut, founded by Frederick W. Gunn. Building intellect, character, fitness, and vision since 1850. On the web at gunnery.org, The Gunnery is not for profit. And from Hartford Stage, where Shakespeare returns to the Hartford Stage. A Midsummer Night's Dream through October 5th. For tickets and information, visit hartfordstage.org. Sunny today with highs in the upper 70s. Tonight mostly clear with a low around 50 degrees. Thursday, sunny, highs in the low 70s. Thursday night clear with lows dipping into the low 40s. Friday, sunny, highs only in the mid 60s. This is WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station, and WNPR.org.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Over the next 2 days, on Thursday and Friday, at Yale University's Divinity School, there's a conference called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. It's all about nuclear disarmament and nuclear weapons in the world today, something that, honestly, Americans aren't talking very much about with everything else that we're talking about. So we wanted to spend today talking about and taking your questions and concerns at 860-275-7266 or email wherewelive@wnpr.org. Our phone guests are Jonathan Schell, a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and author of The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of the Nuclear Danger. Also Jonathan Granoff, he's the president of the Global Security Institute. And joining us in studio in Hartford here, Reverend Tyler Wigg Stevenson, the policy director of Faithful Security. One of the things we left off with before our break, Reverend Stevenson, was this idea of it's a world in which nuclear nations get to decide who has nuclear weapons and who doesn't have nuclear weapons. And I know that's one of the things you're hoping to talk about during the course of this conference over the next 2 days. Maybe talk about that, and I can open up to all three of our guests about this. This sense that the United States, in essence, is able to decide who gets to have nuclear weapons and who doesn't.
Well, I think the United States would like to be able to decide who gets to have nuclear weapons and who doesn't, but it's precisely that dynamic that's leading us alarmingly quickly toward a precipice that I'm afraid we're going to teeter over. What it boils down to is that we're creating a situation where we create necessity and incentive for other nations to want to develop nuclear weapons. So if you were the worst sort of dictator today and you look around and you see that Kim Jong-il's statues are still standing proudly in his public squares and Saddam Hussein's statues have been pulled down by tanks, well, one has nuclear weapons and the other one didn't. What's the message to you? And so our own policies that, these are vital for our own security but forbidden for anybody else is really creating a situation in which other nations are going to have all the interest in the world to develop their own bomb, and nothing could be worse for the security of the United States than that situation. So what our policies presently are ignoring is the principle of reciprocity, which as a Christian and a person of faith, I think are written into the fabric of the universe, so to speak, that what we do will influence others, and others are going to push back. So I think the thing that the people really need to understand, and the thing that should wake the American public up, is that regardless of whether or not you liked nuclear weapons during the Cold War, and regardless whether you think the policies were wise, in the present day, It is a nonpartisan consensus of top foreign policymakers that the nuclear weapons that we think are there to keep us safe are actually taking us into a situation of extreme danger. And the only way to undo that is to create the situation of global norms where it's not acceptable for anybody to have nuclear weapons.
Well, I'll ask Jonathan Granoff quickly. Is there any security benefit the United States can claim to maintaining this nuclear arsenal at this point, given the rest of the world condition?
The argument is that they are the ultimate hammer, and our willingness to threaten to use them brings people into line. But Bob McNamara, at an event that we did at the United Nations, made it very clear, in my opinion. He said, you can't use nuclear weapons against the state that has nuclear weapons. That's suicidal. It's patently immoral to use nuclear weapons against a state without nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons are of no value against terrorists. And therefore, they are a relic of a past era, than that there is no problem as dangerous as the nuclear weapons, as the nuclear weapons themselves. I'm proud to say that I have this capacity to speak to the people of Connecticut, because they have a congressman, Chris Shays, in the southern part of the state, who held comprehensive and robust and profoundly important hearings on this subject when he was the chairman of the Subcommittee on Homeland Security and International Security. And Dr. Hans Blix and myself and Ambassador Tom Graham, who negotiated the treaties for Ronald Reagan, and representatives of the Defense Department and the Department of Energy, all testified. And what I can say from that, and I would urge people to go to the Global Security Institute's website or Congressman Shea's website and read that, and you'll see that the members of the government conceded the point that we have to start moving toward disarmament, that they conceded the duty under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And they argue that since the end of the Cold War, we've come down in our arsenals from absolutely burlesque proportions of 80,000 of these devices. And remember, the devices that we have, the nuclear weapons now, have triggering devices the size of that which was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Their destructive capacity simply staggers the imagination. And he had hearings, and in those hearings, there were no good arguments presented by the Department of Energy or the Defense Department as to why we should keep these weapons there. They just give summary conclusions. We have them because they deter dangers, but they cannot articulate what these dangers are.
They can't articulate what these dangers are. And Jonathan Schell, so at a certain point, you would think that this would cause some movement. Why do you think the movement is indeed so slow? If it's so hard for even American military leaders to articulate why indeed they'd want to keep up an arsenal this large?
Yeah, that's a deep mystery to me. And the whole question of our reaction, you know, as human beings to nuclear danger is certainly one of the most riddlesome things I've ever contemplated. You know, quite frankly, these things are weird. They're horrifying and they're weird. They exist in a class of their own. It's a kind of a class of one. Their destructive capacity outclasses anything else by orders of magnitude. There's no city in the world that can't be just erased from the map by a single nuclear weapon of the appropriate size. And it's just always been just very, very difficult, and it's certainly true for me, too, for the human mind to get itself around this thing. After all, it's the first thing, and so far it's the only thing, as far as we know, that can actually extinguish the human race. And that's another matter that's rather imponderable and difficult to think about. And then I think you have the long passage of time. I know if you picture somebody, he's in a living room, let's say, and you've got a couch and a couple of chairs, and then someone comes in and puts a crate of TNT there. And at first there's great alarm, and everyone realizes, yes, this can blow up our entire house. But then six decades roll by, and it hasn't done so. It hasn't blown up the house. And on the one hand, it's a terrible, urgent, present emergency threatening complete destruction. But on the other hand, it's kind of been there for six decades, you know. Now we're entering the second decade, as I titled the book and what I've written and so forth. And there's some kind of ability of the human mind to adjust itself to almost any insanity. And these weapons are insanity, but, and they have been insanity since the first one went off, and they remain that. But somehow we need a new approach to them in our own mind and conscience, and maybe that's one of the things that we're going to be exploring. Certainly it will be in this conference.
Well, and one of the interesting things, of course, and I think we should talk more about the role of terrorist organizations, global terrorist organizations, and their ability to get their hands on nuclear materials and cause, of course, obviously, large numbers of casualties and huge destruction. But what about just the idea of mistakes being made? Arnold Schwarzenegger at a conference said, mistakes are made in every other human endeavor. Why should nuclear weapons be exempt? And it's a certainly very fair question for the panel. I don't know, Tyler Stevenson, if you want to jump in. The sense that just one tiny mistake could wipe an entire city off the map of the earth, and it seems plausible that that could happen.
Well, that's certainly right, and I think there's an illusion that, you know, this is a perfect science because the American public isn't so aware of mistakes that have been made, but mistakes have actually routinely been made throughout the nuclear age, and it's really a wonder that we've made it through unscathed. I think that in large part leads to the difficulty that people have engaging this question. As Jonathan said, to one degree, it's, you know, you're sort of accustomed to this crate of TNT and sitting in the living room. Well, on the other hand, you know, you maybe have put a nice cloth over it and some candles on top, and you know, now you're really getting used to it, and you've forgotten that it's even dangerous.
Just don't light the candles.
You don't even think the TNT blows up anymore. And so I think that failure to perceive that this is really a pressing threat. You know, this gets into the philosophical questions that Jonathan was raising. But one of the truly unique things about nuclear weapons is that they are an unacceptable threat that will give us no lead time. So with climate change, you know, you've got years and years, and then you've got Al Gore discovering PowerPoint and touring the country, and then a film gets made about him, and then people start to care, and then they go to Walmart and buy a high-efficiency light bulb off an end cap or something. But we're not going to get anything like that. And with nuclear weapons, when and if disaster comes, it will come without warning. And I think that It's very, very hard to get very worked up about a potential threat that no one has any evidence for in their lives. But if you read the accounts, what I would say to people is, you know, this is a very real thing, and the fact that it hasn't happened yet doesn't make the possibility of it happening any less so.
But as I pointed out, and that's Tyler Wiggs Stevenson, the policy director of Faithful Security. We're talking about nuclear disarmament on the program today. Our other guests are Jonathan Schell, senior fellow at the Nation Institute, Jonathan Granoff, president of the Global Security Institute. We're going to get to your phone calls in just 1 minute. Although something Tyler Stevenson just said, Jonathan Granoff, I wanted to point out in my introduction, of course, we did get so worked up about it a few years ago. We got so worked up about weapons of mass destruction potentially being built by Saddam Hussein in Iraq that we authorized a war against that country. So we can get worked up about nuclear weapons, can we not?
The phony argument that the next terrorist incident should not be a mushroom cloud clouded the American psyche with fear, and it occluded a rational debate on it. The real danger we should be talking about is the danger of these nuclear weapons, and the argument to have them is essentially, as long as they're there, we should make sure we have them. But let me remind everybody, in 1995, there was a weather satellite went off the coast of Norway, and it appeared to be a Trident launch. Boris Yeltsin had 8 minutes to decide whether civilization would continue. In 1983, it turned out that the Norwegians had told the Russians they were doing this, but it didn't get passed up the command and control. And he had to decide whether to use or lose his arsenal. In 1983, there was a computer error in the then Soviet command and control, and Colonel Stanislav Petrov did not pass on the information that there appeared to be a full-scale American launch. And the only reason he didn't do it was because he was a computer engineer and he knew computers made errors. And also, as he told me in an interview for a documentary that is being made, he believed in God and he said God didn't want to end the world. And the idea that we are that we're safe with the responsible stewardship of these arsenals is shocking to me. We had 13 days in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But as we sit here, we are subject to 300 seconds between India and Pakistan. And should some computer hacker hack into the computer system of either of those countries and make it appear that there's a launch, we all sit downwind. We are as vulnerable today as a person in Delhi, India is facing Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. People in America should understand, as long as we, the most powerful nation in human history, say that we need these weapons for our security, other countries will want them and they will get them. And by accident or design, they will be used. And any use is catastrophic beyond acceptability.
I'd like to get to some phone calls. You can join the conversation about nuclear disarmament on the program, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. Let's go to Johnny, who's calling from Bristol. Johnny, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I had something in mind, but you know, listening to you guys, it's very clear that I completely agree with what you guys are saying. The whole thing, I can't go out without saying that the damage, and please don't take me as one of those conspiracy theory people, which I'm not, but I think that the damage that the Bush government created to the country, to our country, and to the world, with this radical ways of seeing and do what I say and not the way I do it, and everything is good for me, which is not good for the rest of the world, and it's just like what you guys are saying. It's everybody else wants to go and get a nuke because that's the only way to contain a rogue regime like the one we have right now. Gearing towards, give me or I'll blow you up. And it is a commercial enterprise. It is not a defense system anymore. They're using it as a commercial enterprise to go and guarantee their own, whatever they see fit that we might need now or in the future.
Well, Johnny, let me ask you a quick question. Why do you think more Americans aren't talking about this? Why do you think more Americans don't consider the state of the nuclear the continued nuclear arms race across the globe?
Because people are brainwashed. We could answer this question by just asking how could possibly 50% of the country be gearing towards putting another Republican in a White House after 8 years of this complete reckless government?
Johnny,
I'm not a Republican nor Democrat. I don't think the Democrats are much better than them. But, comparing to what we have, the choices that we have, unfortunately, it's completely impossible.
Johnny, thank you very much for your phone call. I appreciate it. I want to get to one more quick phone call before our next break. James is calling from Hamden. James, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Well, I wanted to address the question you asked at the very beginning. When is it all right to use nuclear weapons? And it occurred to me that it's easier to answer that question if you rephrase it in a more accurate way. When is it all right to incinerate hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children and inflict untold suffering on hundreds of thousands more because of where they happen to live?
And James, thank you very much for your phone call. Tyler Wegg-Stevenson, it gets to the heart of, I suppose, not just nuclear weapons, though. And both of our guests, Jonathan Schell and Jonathan Granoff, had pointed out the differences that nuclear weapons possess from other conventional weapons. But isn't this really the larger question about warfare as a whole?
Well, I think the observation that the gentleman brings up is really astute. And I think it speaks to the fact that we've become accustomed to the threat of nuclear weapons. There are other kinds of weapons of mass destruction out there, chemical and biological. Of course, neither chemical nor biological are as devastating as nuclear weapons. But I think it's important to point out chemical weapons were Saddam Hussein's weapons. They've been banned. Nuclear weapons are the weapons that, in the American mind, won World War II. So there's a certain amount of attachment we have to them as legitimate means. But the gentleman brings up a fair point. One use of a nuclear weapon, even if it's poorly deployed, even if it's rather small, is going to cause untold suffering, trillions of dollars in damage, tens or hundreds of thousands or even millions of people dead, potentially. And I think it's exactly helpful, as he said, to think about, to reframe the question and ask yourself some other horrifying, beyond belief tactics that might be used in the name of defense. And we would say, no, 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 we could never do that. That would never be moral. And yet we set up these blinders for ourselves in terms of nuclear weapons because we have this sense now, well, that, you know, they're righteous and that they're the weapons that won the Cold War for us, and we have these sense about them that really separates them in our minds from other weapons that cause undescribable damage.
Our guests are Tyler Wiig Stevenson, Policy Director of Faithful Security and Director of the Two Futures Project. Also, Jonathan Schell, Senior Fellow at the Nation Institute, who's teaching a course at Yale University on nuclear disarmament. Jonathan Granoff is President of Global Security Institute. We're all talking about a two-day conference coming up at Yale Divinity School called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. We'd like to hear your thoughts and comments. 860-275-7266. Who has the right to possess nuclear weapons? Can we really disarm the entire world? 860-275-7266. We'll be right back where we live.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. There's a lot at stake in our country's choices this year, and there's a lot of noise. But there's an important, honest conversation taking place that cuts to the heart of what really matters. It's right here, every day, and it's about you and your country and our world. Come hear what it's all about. Join us for the next On Point.
Listen to On Point this morning at 10, right after Where We Live, here on WNPR and online at WNPR.org. Funding for WNPR comes from our members and from Genomis, enabling doctors to personalize drug treatments for mental illness, heart disease, and cancer based on the DNA of each patient. Genomis, bringing DNA-guided medicine to healthcare today. Information at dnatests@genomis.net. And from Wesleyan University's Center for the Arts, presenting the U.S. premiere of Compagnie, Marie Chouinard's highly charged dance spectacle Orpheus and Eurydice, September 19th and 20th. Wesleyan.edu/CFA. Sunny today, highs in the upper 70s. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 50. Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the low 70s. Thursday night, clear, lows dipping into the low 40s. Friday, sunny, highs only in the mid-60s. This is WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station, and WNPR.org.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankowski. Tomorrow, Connecticut's property tax system is seen by most observers as broken, unfair, and in desperate need of overhaul. But that argument has been made for years with no real promise of a change to the system. We will be live at the state capitol tomorrow hosting a forum on the property tax with state lawmakers and policy experts, and we'd like you to join us. If you'd like more information on the forum and how to attend, you can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. And as always, you can go to our website, WNPR.org, keyword where, you can download podcasts of the program, and you can also join us with comments on future shows. Today on the show, we're talking about a two-day conference that's happening at Yale Divinity School on the 18th and 19th of the month called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. It's about nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament. Joining us in the studio is Reverend Tyler Wiig Stevenson, Policy Director of Faithful Security. Jonathan Schell joins us by phone, Senior Fellow at the Nation Institute. Jonathan Granoff is President of the Global Security Institute. We're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. When we started doing research for this, we read a very interesting article written for the Wall Street Journal, Tyler Stevenson. It's called Toward a Nuclear-Free World and a World Free of Nuclear Weapons. It was written and then updated a year later, originally written in January 4th of 2007. When you hear the names on this list, on this op-ed, George Shultz, William Perry, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, you start to think about the gravity of what we're talking about over this two-day conference and on this program today. These are some people who have been very much on the side of nuclear weaponry over the course of time, and they're saying in 2007 and again in 2008, it's time to rid the world of nuclear weapons.
I think it's funny we're paying such attention to an article written by such a bunch of hippies, right? you know, these are guys who, some of them, you know, and we work with them, but they're not utopian, they're not naive, and they're calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons, not because, you know, they have some leftist agenda. These are very conservative people. They're nuclear hawks. They're former Cold Warriors. The important thing that this communicates, they've since gotten the endorsement for their plan of 70% of the living former individuals who served as Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and National Security Advisor. The foreign policy elite gets this. It's an idea that whose time has come. They understand there's no use for these things anymore. Military commanders don't want them. The politicians with heads on their shoulders don't want them. But this awareness hasn't trickled down to the American public yet. And I think it's vital that we start paying attention, because right now we need to get rid of nuclear weapons for our security. We can get rid of nuclear weapons technologically and diplomatically, and morally speaking, we must get rid of them. It's rare that you have a policy item where those three things line up. There's a lot of things we have to do that we shouldn't do, and there's a lot of things we can do that we shouldn't do, too. There are some things we should do that we can't do. But with nuclear weapons, we must, we can, and we should. And there's really no excuse for the next president not making this a top priority of his administration.
Among those names that signed on to this, Madeleine Albright and James Baker and Robert McFarlane and Robert McNamara and Colin Powell, William Cohen, so many other names that we know of throughout American history. I'm wondering, Jonathan Schell, maybe, what is the process of getting rid of these weapons? If it's indeed something we can do, what do we do to draw down our overall nuclear arsenal?
You know, it's really a strange inverted situation, because normally when you have a radical proposal of this kind, and this is radical, the idea of getting rid of nuclear weapons, although in my opinion keeping them is a more radical thing to do, usually you have a public movement, public interest, and which is notably weak at this time. It's not inexistent, but it's weak. And yet you have the sort of crown princes and kings and queens of the establishment calling for this. So the missing piece in the puzzle has been public interest. But obviously, you know, you and I don't have nuclear weapons under our bed, so we can't each personally get rid of our own nuclear weapon. It's different from global warming in that way. We can't recycle them. Only a president can recycle nuclear weapons. Only heads of state can do that. And so it is something that should flow into the political campaign. On the optimistic side, first Obama and then McCain in a slightly weaker way, did associate themselves with this article and this proposal. But, you know, politicians say all kinds of things, and 95% of it never really gets on the action agenda at the end of the day. And so really what's needed is that level of public interest. I don't know what you do except to speak on radio programs like this to try to stir it up.
Well, I wish I have a call from Aaron asking about this. Aaron is calling from Hartford. Aaron, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. It just boggles my mind that this discussion isn't more pervasive in, you know, our daily media and our daily life. I just, you know, I think of this independently. I haven't read too much about this, but I sometimes think, what if I'm just walking in the park and I get evaporated? Because it could happen. And I'm wondering, We have so much media attention to climate change and all these diseases, and we're inundated with a lot of causes. This is like you've discussed. We have former conservative Bob McNamara on. Everybody seems to be on one side on this, and I don't hear the major candidates talking about it. I'm wondering how what's being done, or how can this be made more pervasive.
Well, let me put this to, I appreciate that. Let me put this to Tyler Stevenson, obviously, taking a look at some of these moral issues, taking a look at some of the ways in which the religious community can address them is certainly one way, Tyler Stevenson. That's part of what you're talking about the next few days, but go ahead.
Well, let me just say, I understand where you're coming from, Aaron. When I started working on nuclear weapons, the sort of, and I understand actually where the American public's coming from. When I started working on this issue, the fear becomes almost paralyzing. And because you're dealing with such a overwhelming issue that seems beyond the scope of, write a letter to my congressman, that sort of thing. that there seems like there's almost nothing you can do, and a lot of people just sort of turn away in hopelessness. Well, I want to say that the best thing you can do is actually to start doing something, because then you start to feel a lot better about your capacity to influence the situation. Well, one thing you could do is to either register. I'm not sure whether they're full yet, but there's this conference at Yale Divinity School. It's yale.edu/faith, and that'll take you to the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. If you can't register, you could tune into some of the webcasts and you could learn a little bit more. You could learn what this discussion's like. I'm involved with two organizations. If you're a person of faith, and you're concerned about this, a multi-faith coalition is faithfulsecurity.org. You can look at our website and find out ways you can get involved. And the Two Futures Project is a project I'm running specifically targeted at younger evangelicals, twofuturesproject.org. I'd also commend to you the Global Security Institute's website, where you can read this Wall Street Journal op-ed. I mean, that'll make you feel that'll make your whole day reading this op-ed from these guys. So it's gsinstitute.org. There are a lot of ways to get involved, and I think by making this an issue of personal commitment — this is where I do the altar call, I'm a Baptist preacher — by making this an issue of personal commitment, you start to become a place where other people can engage, and they, well, why are you so concerned about that? And then you can tell them, and you've got a reason, and then it becomes a voting issue, and then candidates start to care, and we can really make sure it gets on the agenda.
I want to get to Joe in Tallinn, and thank you very much for your phone call. Joe is calling from Tallinn. Go ahead, you're on Where We Live.
Hey, thanks very much. I don't think anybody really particularly likes nuclear weapons and wants to see them eliminated to the extent you can, but I think your proposition and logic is a little bit flawed, and I think it's a little bit irresponsible. But first of all, this is a technological issue. The genie is out of the bottle. The materials, the know-how, and the ability exist throughout the world, and whether we choose to unilaterally or do disarm with another group of people doesn't ensure our safety. And I think it's equally immoral to disarm ourselves and put down our defenses and put ourselves at risk. So I think it's a much more complicated issue, and it's easy to say what you're saying, but I think it's fundamentally flawed.
Well, and I appreciate your phone call very much, Joe. I want to get to a quick comment. So Joe really makes two points. Jonathan Schell, Jonathan Granoff, I don't know if you both want to jump in. One has to do with the technology is out there. People are learning how to make nuclear weapons beyond just the major powers. So that is one question. The other one has to do with the morality of disarming ourselves and putting ourselves at risk. Maybe
I'd like to take the second one if I could.
And quickly, if you would, because we're running low on time. Go ahead.
Very simply, I agree completely with the caller. It would be completely irresponsible and patently immoral for the United States to unilaterally disarm. We'd be creating instability and putting our country at risk. It's precisely because of that reason that 189 countries in the world have agreed to make a commitment to nuclear disarmament. Then the issue becomes very practical, technical, as the man says, and I agree completely. The International Atomic Energy Agency has never had a budget for all of its inspections to get control of the nuclear materials. And let me remind you, the technology's out there, but the nuclear materials can be controlled, they can be inventoried, and they can be sequestered. They've never had a budget in excess of $120 million for all the inspections for the whole year. According to the Brookings Institute, our country has spent over $5.5 trillion with no public debate. We're spending more than $110 million a day on the arsenal. If you switch that equation, the technical solution of controlling the materials and making us all much safer is obtainable.
Let's quickly go to Neil in East Hampton. Neil, go ahead quickly. You're on Where We Live.
Okay. The problem lies not with the rest of the world as much as with the United States in terms of its leadership. If you have a UN that functions, or a League of Nations, or international organizations, you can pressure the world in terms of nuclear disarmament. But if you're not prepared to disarm yourself, nobody else is going to do it. And you have to remember that the only people who ever dropped a bomb in the world were the United States. The other problem that you have is the threats don't come from other countries. The threats come from radical groups that might be willing to do it.
Well,
religious extremists to a large degree.
Because we're running low on time, I just want to go to Jonathan Schell. Jonathan Granoff, just a moment ago, Jonathan Schell, talked about there are ways to be able to control the inventory of all this nuclear material. Do you think that nuclear weapons can be kept safe from terrorist organizations?
Well, the only way to do that is to roll back the...
technology on a global basis. And then you get a substantial degree of safety. In other words, the best way to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists is to get rid of that technology, and that means eliminating nuclear weapons globally. Let me just comment on the possibility question. Someone once said, if something has been done, it's possible. Look at South America, just for an example. That's a country where at least that's a continent where at least two countries, Brazil and Argentina, were fully nuclear capable. And they looked at that option, and they were heading down that road towards nuclear weapons. And they backed off. They backed off and they backed down. And the result was a treaty that has a complicated name, Tlatelolco, which turned that continent into a nuclear weapon free zone. And then they joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And there's a norm in the world. The norm in the world is not to have nuclear weapons. In other words, out of the all the nations in the world, I don't know what the number is, 190 thereabouts, there are only the nine that I enumerated before that actually have nuclear weapons, and 180 plus or more have done just fine throughout the nuclear age without nuclear weapons. So really, if you look at it in that light, it's a matter of bringing nine rogues into line with the global norms, and that seems like a possible thing to do.
Jonathan Schell is senior fellow at the Nation Institute. He's author of The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of the Nuclear Danger. He joined us by phone today. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Jonathan Granoff, president of the Global Security Institute. He's also taking part in this conference coming up. Jonathan Granoff, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Tyler Wiggs Stevenson, policy director of Faithful Security and also director of the Two Futures Project. This is all part of a Yale Divinity School two-day conference that's happening. It's called Are We Safe Yet? Vulnerability and Security in an Anxious Age. And we'll have information about that on our website, WNPR.org, as well as some of the links that we've been talking about on today's show. Tyler Stevenson, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Tomorrow, we are going to be live at the state capitol. We're going to be talking about property tax reform. If you'd like to get information about how to join us for this live forum at the old judiciary room at the state capitol, you can email us wherewelive@WNPR.org. Of course, you can always join the conversation online, wherewelive, WNPR.org, keyword where. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.